This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
One, we want to reunite this country. This country has been divided, for so many years, and the divisions are visible. You just have to look.
That's the new Zambian president, Hakainde Hichilema, in an interview with VOA before he was sworn into office today. Details coming up. Also, unknown gunmen today attacked Nigeria's Defense Academy, an elite officers' training school in the country's northwest. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Today, in Zambia, Hakainde Hichilema took office as president nearly 2 weeks after the country's national election. He defeated incumbent Edgar Lungu, who conceded defeat after threatening to challenge the election results. Last week, VOA's Peter Cloti sat down for a lengthy interview with President Hichilema. Today, we bring the first of three parts of the interview.
It's very clear what our agenda is, and that's what the people of Zambia bought. And they bought two fundamental focal areas. One, we want to reunite this country. This country has been divided, for so many years, and the divisions are visible. You just have to look anywhere. You see them in the workplaces, in the market areas, divisions all over. So we want to reunite this country, because on the platform of unity, on the platform of peace and stability, we can then do the second anchor of what we are selling, what we sold to the people of Zambia. What is that? Reconstruction, rebuilding our country. So that's rebuilding the country, A, economically, to bring back economic prosperity, to bring back investment, to bring back jobs. Today is a new day. After we won the election, you should have seen the celebrations across the country. And by the way, the mandate we have is a nationwide mandate.
Right.
We basically, you know, it's unprecedented. It doesn't happen in an autocratic environment to deliver the sort of resounding victory that we delivered. I want to thank the people of Zambia. I want to thank the youth who endured long hours on the queues. As early as 01 in the morning, they were on the queues. Up to about 22 hours, 23 hours for some. For others, up to the following day in the morning. Because the turnout was huge. And that turnout, once I saw it, huge lines, huge, I said, this is it. Because they wanted change. Thank
right.
you.
Mr. President, within the first 100 days, or perhaps 1 year, what do you seek to achieve for the people of Zambia? Because I understand, last time when you spoke, that you are daring to go. What would you want to have achieved within the first 100 days and perhaps the first year?
We will restore order in this country. There's not much you can do when there's chaos everywhere. Chaos in the markets, chaos in the bus stops. We sent that signal that nobody would take away people's rights to be in a place when they want to. Just that press briefing we had, there's now order in the markets. There's no hooliganism in the markets. And this is the beginning. Because once we have order, we have normalcy, we have civility, we can then move to do other things. So definitely, because you're not local, for locals, I would have gone on to say, even the councils now are extremely delighted, excited that they will begin to earn revenue, which was earned by militias, party militias, armed militias, that were not just brutalizing citizens, but taking away their income that they would apply to pay salaries for local authority workers, that they would apply to provide services, garbage collection, and things like that for the residents of those cities. Excitement all over.
On several occasions, you have said that the debt is unsustainable.
Indeed.
So, Mr. President, how do you plan on resolving this? Because some people are suggesting that it is crashing the economy. What plans do you have to jumpstart the economy?
We want to make sure first, as a starting point, we determine what is the true debt, because there's a gray area there. Mm-hmm. What is the quantum of this debt? How much would we comfortably, confidently say this is the debt position, foreign and domestic? We don't know. Numbers are being thrown around. So we want to make sure very quickly in the next 100 days, within the next 100 days, establish what the true debt position is. And one of the principles we use is that sit down with the debt providers, debt stockholders, and have a professional conversation, a mature conversation, respectful conversation, to see how together, when it together, we come out of this mess. I come from a business background. You don't pay your debt, you're not credible. Mm-hmm. Now we are not credible, but we want to bring the country back to credibility. Because we bring that respectability and professionalism, I think the debt stockholders will also be happy that now there's a new leadership, there's a new team that is willing to come to the table to find a common solution, win-win situation.
That was Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema speaking with Peter Cloete, the host of VOA's Nightline Africa program. Chad's former president, Hissène Habré, an ally of the West during the Cold War, who was later jailed for war crimes and crimes against humanity, died today in Senegal at age 79, the spokesperson at the Senegalese Justice Ministry said. Habré ruled Chad from 1982 to 1990 after deposing his predecessor, Gukuni Ouédou. Thousands were reportedly killed, tortured, and raped during his presidency, which ended when he was ousted in 1990. He fell ill in jail about a week ago and was taken to a clinic in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, before being moved to the hospital principal, where he died. For more, International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with reporter Alpha Diallo in Dakar.
The only thing we know of his last woman is from the wife. About 3 months ago, he was critically ill. The wife said that the government is giving him some sort of a bill so that he can go to the house and be cured by the family. But that was not granted. That was refused by the prison administration. And just recently, about a couple of weeks ago, Habré's condition was getting worse, and it was reported that he contracted COVID-19. Until day before yesterday, he was being treated in a special health facility, a private health facility. But when his condition got worse, he was transferred to the main hospital principal in Dakar, where he died early this morning.
Has the Chadian government made any announcements?
We have been monitoring the news within the Senegalese government. Only this morning, there were most of the private radio stations were announcing that his condition was so terrible. His condition is quite critical, and he's been transferred to a special health facility. That's the main Senegalese hospital, the hospital principal. But then it was not even reported by the Senegalese government that he died. Until this morning, where the news broke that he died of COVID in the early hours of the morning.
What has been the reaction of the people in Ivory Coast and other commentators on the passing of former President Habré?
Mixed reaction here, downtown Dakar here. Most people are glued to their radio stations when the news broke that the former Chadian leader who was in this country has just died of COVID. Because some people, they are very angry. Some people are not taking the news because they are angry. They said that Habré, he lived in Senegal for so many years when he was crippled and fled to Senegal. He lived here with the people. As you know, he lived in a locality called Wakam, and he has been interacting with the local people. He was helping so many Senegalese people. Even he's been paying, he's been helping, families, to pay the school fees of their children, all these things. So people were not happy when he was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment.
What do you think former President Habré will be most remembered for?
I don't know, in Chad, well, in Senegal here, people will remember, because the people, most of them tell you that he was a very good Muslim, though they were surprised that all those charges were leveled to him, all those gross human rights violations when he was president of Chad. Now, in Chad, he will be remembered, a former president who exiled, and he was so interacting with the local community, and he was helping the people and all that thing. But elsewhere, he will be seen as a president who was so wicked to his people And because of that, he was, even when he fled, I mean, these charges were leveled against him, and eventually he was arrested and then sentenced to life imprisonment.
That's reporter Alpha Jallo speaking with International Edition's Chididuo 4 from Dakar. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and his Prosperity Party won landslide victories in June elections, but a fifth of the country saw their balloting postponed until September 6th. Now, according to the National Election Board of Ethiopia, the date has been pushed back to September 30th. The decision followed a meeting with politicians who told the board that it is not appropriate to hold elections now given the country's current situation. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports that the United States has imposed new sanctions on Eritrea over its involvement in neighboring Ethiopia's deadly Tigray conflict. A statement by the U.S. Treasury Department says Eritrea's Chief of Staff of the Defense Forces, Philippos Walde Yohannes, has been sanctioned under the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act for leading an entity accused of despicable acts including massacres, widespread sexual assault, and the execution of boys. The statement again calls on Eritrea to remove its soldiers from Ethiopia's Tigray region permanently. Tunisian President Kais Saied extended his 30-day suspension of parliament indefinitely today after it expired without the formation of a new government that he promised. He had been joining most Tunisians and blaming the Islamist Ennahdha party as bearing sole responsibility for the country's stagnation. Amy Hawthorne, deputy director of the Project for Middle East Democracy, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the popular anger that some anti-democracy regional powers exploited.
There is a lot of popular frustration, even anger, I've seen in recent weeks toward Ennahda. Now, why is Ennahda? Why are Tunisians and possibly President Saied blaming Ennahda more than any other party? I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that Ennahda is the strongest political party in the three parliamentary elections that Tunisia has had in the past decade with a plurality of votes. So it is the party that has done the best electorally compared to all other parties, and it has a plurality of seats in parliament. Its president, Rachid Ghannouchi, is the speaker of parliament, and it has participated or backed all the Tunisian governments that have been in place since the revolution. So at one level, it's natural that people are going to focus their ire and their frustration and their anger on the party that is seen to have had the greatest share of power. Another factor is that Ennahda has not necessarily been responsive to a lot of the demands that many Tunisians have had to really tackle corruption, reform the interior ministry to make it less abusive. There are a number of issues like that where the widespread perception is that Ennahda has been more interested in protecting its own role in the system, its own privilege, than in really tackling these problems. And since July 25th, we've heard some prominent Ennahda members basically saying, as you're sorry that we made mistakes. We didn't really listen to the people as much as we should have. There's a third factor, which is there's a strong legacy in Tunisia among some Tunisians of antipathy, distrust toward political Islam, towards Ennahda, which of course was demonized, completely outlawed, banned during most of the Ben Ali dictatorship. There's a lot of Tunisians who grew up hearing messages or maybe forming their own opinions that political Islam, Ennahda, was not to be trusted. Now, Ennahda says that they've broken away from political Islam, and it is true that they have acted politically in some cases in a more moderate way than some might have expected, while hewing to their strongly held positions on other issues. But there is a very strong, I would say, mistrust, distrust of Ennahda among some Tunisians, and some who would even like to exclude the party completely from the political scene. Tunisia really can't be a democracy if most successful or wide vote getting party is banned from the scene. Now, it hasn't been banned yet. We don't know what's going to happen, but there are certainly fears of members of Ennahda that they're going to come in for a really, really harsh wave of repression.
Let's not forget, Amy, the regional influence. In April, Qais Saied was received with great fanfare by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo. Then Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain sent their foreign ministers to Tunis, backing Saied's moves, which are conceived as anti-democratic. Why are these countries supporting such moves?
Well, I think they're supporting such moves and hoping that Tunisia will become a new dictatorship under Qais Saied, because Tunisia is the only country to come out of the 2011 uprisings as a democracy, a flawed and shaky one to be sure, but a democracy as it is commonly defined in the political sense. And all of these countries all deeply autocratic, deeply authoritarian regimes. So they have something at stake in seeing Tunisian democracy fail. And more than that, all of these regimes are very, very much against political Islam. And they include Ennahda as part of political Islam, even though Ennahda itself has formally broken away from political Islam. But these regional authoritarian regimes do see Ennahda as an Islamist movement. The fact that an Islamist movement has been playing a leading role in government in Tunisia for the past decade, based on the results of free elections, which none of these countries hold, of course, is something that is very concerning to these authoritarian leaders. So those countries believe that they have really something to gain from doing whatever they can to help Tunisian democracy fail, and also possibly helping to remove Ennahda from the political scene in Tunisia. So we'll have to see really how much influence those autocratic countries in other parts of the region will have over him and over the unfolding situation.
That was Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of the Project for Middle East Democracy, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. South Africa's Justice Department said today it will extradite Mozambique's former finance minister, Manuel Chang, to his home country instead of the United States, where he faces corruption and fraud charges. Chang is expected to stand trial in Mozambique on charges of being involved in a $2 billion loan scam while he was finance minister from 2005 to 2015. Chang has been in the custody of South Africa since 2018, when he was arrested at the request of the United States, which has indicted him on charges of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, securities fraud, and money laundering. A South African decision comes on the second day of a massive trial in Maputo in what is known as the Hidden Debt Scandal. Chang and 19 others are suspected of corruption linked to loans, ostensibly for a project spanning tuna fishing, shipyard development, and maritime security. But authorities say vast sums were paid out in kickbacks, and many promised benefits never came through. The other 19 suspects on trial include state security officials and Armando Ndambi Guibuza, the son of former Mozambican President Armando Guibuza. President Guibuza was in office when the loans were taken out. Yannick Michel is a reporter in Maputo who is following the trial. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the case.
The trial, which began yesterday, brought to the court bench 19 defendants, 21 lawyers. The trial took place within the maximum security penitentiary itself for fearing a breakout of jail. The first day was dedicated for preliminary questions that already revealed other and unknown scandal. The indictment's reading yesterday took about 2 hours. Lawyers yesterday defended the release of the remaining incarcerated defendants with expired pretrial detention terms. Today, the trial is still going with the defendant Cipriano Mutota inquiry. So next days, we cannot expect many developments. The defendants all of them will be heard by the judge. And after that, some preliminary balance can be brought out to light.
What has the public reaction been to the trial, to this case? Are people keeping a close eye on the proceedings, or does nobody care?
Throughout the social media networks, throughout the groups, WhatsApp and Facebooks, whatever, all of the social media networks, plenty of people are commentating, are writing their minds about what's going on, and the general sentiment, of the people is that they demand justice, but there is a small sector that doesn't believe that this trial is a proper trial. They think this is just a front. It's a trial just a front, and after the trial, after the prosecution, after the indictment, they will all go free and pay some cash instead of doing their time incarcerated. So there are two sectors of the society who believe that this trial is a real trial, and the other one doesn't really believe that is a real trial.
That was journalist Yannick Machel in Maputo speaking with VOA's Kate Pounderson. Nigeria's information minister Lai Mohammed has confirmed to VOA that Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau is dead. His comments in an interview with VOA House of Services' Grace Oyenubi came 5 months after the militant group said he had died. There have been several false reports of his death in the past. Mohammed told VOA last Friday the government had not previously said that Shekau had died because it was waiting to confirm the death. The Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people in northeastern Nigeria over more than a decade in an attempt to impose a strict version of Islam. Unknown gunmen today attacked Nigeria's Defense Academy, an elite officers' training school in the country's northwest. An internal army message seen by the French news agency AFP said, during the assault, two officers were killed, one wounded and another abducted. No group so far has claimed responsibility. The attack on the academy is a blow to the military, which is battling jihadists in the northeast and heavily armed criminal gangs in the northwest. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokwili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.